I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
This isn't Red John. Red John thinks of himself as a showman, an artist. He has a strong sense of theater. In all the previous killings, he made sure that the first thing that anyone sees is the face on the wall. You see the face first, and you know. You know what's happened, and you feel dread. Then, and only then, do you see the body of the victim. Always in that order. Here, it's the opposite. The first thing you see is the body, and you have to look around to see the face on the wall. Doesn't play nearly as well, does it? Dear Mr. Jane, I do not like to be slandered in the media, especially by a dirty money-grubbing fraud. If you were a real psychic instead of a dishonest little worm, you wouldn't need to open the door to see what I've done to your lovely wife and child.
We're back again with Bruno Heller, creator-producer of The Mentalist, whose season premiere airs Sunday, September 30th at 10 p.m. on CBS, right here on the TV Time Machine. Now, in the pilot episode, Patrick Jane and his history was made really clear at the outset. Tell us about that backstory and the significance of Red John.
Well, I think the backstory hinges on the fact that it was his own hubris and arrogance and kind of ambition, greed, if you like, that caused his family's death in his mind. He was overreaching. He had such pride and faith and arrogance about his skills and his success that he wasn't thinking. And that essential guilt is what drove him out of the ambivalent world he was in into this more virtuous world he's in now. And Red John is really just a personification of death. I mean, it's that simple. Patrick Jane is very much alive and is very much about being alive in the face of death. And Red John is the fate that comes to us all in the end. Like I say, I always like to have, you know, I mean, The Mentalist is not really a realist show, but it's as real as we can make it, given the slightly unlikely premise that a mentalist would be working for the police. But given that, we try and make it real. And I wanted to give it an epic quality. And the search for this guy had to have an epic feel as opposed to his kind of sordid feel. Like, in fact, most serial killers are sordid, sad, pathetic little men living on their own in bedsits. And, you know, they're crazy people and inadequate in various ways. And that doesn't really make a very good adversary for someone, you know, a big character like Jane. So I knew, you know, these are all kind of sort of basic story principal things. He needed a character that could balance Jane, and he needed to be big and powerful, but on the other hand, it needed to be, there's a Moby Dick aspect to the story. You know, Moby Dick can't pop up every week and, you know, spout. And if you have a great villain, and this is probably true of all great villains, for instance, the shark in Jaws, the more you see the shark, the less menacing and villainous and shocking he is. And, you know, in terms of, if you're not thinking about the 100th episode, then you're not really thinking clearly about the frame that you're painting your picture in, because that's what all network TV shows aspire to. It's foolish to come up with a story that doesn't allow you to do that, not to name any names. So clearly it had to be an elusive and powerful and charismatic figure. So I kind of, you know, the name is a kind of mashup of Robert Bly and Grimm's fairy tales. It's in the Middle Ages, people would scare their children with a character like Red John. So he needed to have a certain sort of mystical, mythical, legendary fairy tale aspect to him, precisely because we will eventually, I guarantee it, find him.
Good.
Everyone knows what happens at the end of Moby Dick or any of these stories, so I'm not giving anything away there. We will find him. But he can't be popping up and becoming a kind of beloved regular character on the show, which means he has to have that elusive, mythical aspect to him. And then it becomes not quite technical, but it becomes, you know, it's a very simple series of steps there. If he's as powerful as he is and no one can catch him, he needs to have allies and helpers, and there needs to be much more to what's going on than what we initially see or what we initially think.
The resolution of the Red John question, is that ultimately intimidating to you?
Not intimidating, it's certainly...
Or daunting?
Daunting? Yeah, daunting. Yes, just because, you know, it's like when you start telling someone an extremely long joke, you better make sure the punchline is funny, because you're going to end up with egg on your face if it's not. But I wouldn't say daunting. It's like I'm aware, we're all aware, that has to be a satisfying and coherent and convincing solution to this long detective story. But no, I love the challenge. A lot of storytelling is kind of not quite vamping, and shtick sounds dismissive of it, but you're doing a kind of performance that you can roll along. You know, Baker could entertain you with the phone book for half an hour, and I could write that phone book quite easily. You know, in network TV, as opposed to writing some, you know, incredibly edgy and shocking scene on cable TV, the challenges on a network show are, how do you deliver beyond the audience's expectations? How do you create so much story and keep it coherent? And how do you thread your way through this massive amount of story and come to a cohesive and satisfying end? Because if you actually think about the story we've told already in real terms, and this is true of any TV show, even the sort of the ones that are sort of docudrama style, it's ludicrous. You know, nobody has that much incident or story or crimes happen to them. And, you know, the most experienced police detective in the world doesn't deal with, you know, one season's worth of crime in their lifetime. So you kind of have this massive ball of story that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the challenge is keeping all of those story strands and all of that history true and accurate and as true to life as possible. That's the network TV writer's professional challenge, as opposed to, you know, other more chamber piece like art forms.
Now, another intriguing character on The Mentalist is Cho, played by Tim Kang, as we'll hear in the following clip.
Are you aware that on the night of her murder, your wife was meeting a lover?
Yes. The local authorities told me they suspected as much.
Did you know she had a lover prior to her death, I mean?
No. Do you have a name? Is he a suspect?
We have a name. He's not a suspect.
Who is he?
I'm not at liberty to say.
I want his name.
You can't have it.
Are you sure, Agent Cho? Because I can make one phone call and your career is toast.
That's impressive. The best I can get with one call is a pizza. Now, this business dinner you were at in San Francisco, what's the timing on that and who else was there?
My people can give you times, names, and numbers. We're done here.
Thanks for your cooperation.
Tell us about that character, and particularly what makes him tick.
Well, Tim Kang makes him tick, really. The character was conceived... the character was conceived very much as he plays him, but it required a very particular sort of dry comedic attitude, and an actor who's willing to always do less than more to get his effects.
Now, was that his idea, to play it sort of as a sort of just the facts, ma'am, type of attitude?
Well, it was, you know, casting, which is a whole other conversation. Casting, especially TV, you're really trying to cast to the character. You know, you want someone to come in and, without being given notes, just embody what you had in mind. Because, frankly, you know, again, unlike movies, however good the actor is, the pace is so quick and the schedule is so grueling that you haven't got time for elaborate rehearsals or elaborate notes or refining a performance. So actors have to very much embody who the character is in the first place. And Tim came in and he had that dry, and it's not quite mean, but and it's not quite cold. There's a slang Italian word for it, menefregista. Don't ask me to spell it.
Right. Got it.
They say Dean Martin had it, which
right.
is a kind of amused coldness and a kind of internal confidence. Cool, if you like, is another word for it, although that word has become misused. And I very much wanted to create an Asian character, Korean character, who was not simply a stock ethnic character, but had some aspects, you know, an oriental aspect, if you like. There's much more in Asian cultures, there is much more value in face. And Cho is someone with a great deal of face. He doesn't lose face, and sort of it's a great quality and strength. It's also a great comedic and dramatic backboard to play off. In very simple terms, if you have a character like that and you get a reaction shot from him to a gag and he doesn't give you anything,
right.
It makes the gag funnier.
Right.
Because
less is more.
Yeah. But because Tim is able to put across the guy's essential decency and warmth and intelligence, the audience both likes him and appreciates that kind of sharp edge he has on him. It's funny how those things work, because it's a chemistry thing and you can't really tell until you see it in action whether it will really work. But Tim nailed it in the first audition. It went from there.
Bruno, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with Bruno Heller, creator-producer of The Mentalist, whose season premiere airs Sunday, September 30th at 10 p.m. on CBS, who is riding along with us on the TV Time Machine.